Alan Finkel, Dr. Alan Finkel, Order of Australia, is with you. He's Australia's chief scientist and has been so for, about 2.5 years now. Is that right, Alan?
Libby, that's correct. Good morning.
Good morning. As a Melbourne supporter, I welcome you to the conversation.
Thanks, Libby.
Has your commitment to the Melbourne Football Club been consistent or...?
It's waned over the years. So when I was young, I used to go with my brother and friends consistently to the football to see Melbourne. It was an exciting period. But over the last, I guess, 50 years, I've gone from being a believer to being an agnostic. And now you'd have to say I'm atheist.
But are you coming back?
I'm not sure. At least they're in the finals this year.
So you're feeling a little flutter?
Just a little.
A little flutter. That's nice. May I ask you, just before we kick off, about artificial intelligence, because that's why we're here. This segment brought to you by my parents, Beverly and Eric Gore, who went to Dr. Christine McDonald's Smallwood oration that she organised at the Austin Hospital where you spoke. My parents collared you and got you for this program. So thank you. Very hard to turn mum down, right?
She's very enthusiastic.
Especially with dad standing behind her. Is your tenure in any way affected, given that you were a direct appointment of Malcolm Turnbull, former Prime Minister, are you affected by this leadership change with ScoMo and Josh in the top seats?
Certainly not in any technical sense. So I was appointed through the auspices of Malcolm Turnbull, but the appointment of the Chief Scientist is a Cabinet-approved appointment to the Commonwealth of Australia. So it's not to a political party, nor is it to a department. So it's actually a direct contract, and I'm doing a 5-year contract with 2 years to go.
Great. So you're sort of mid-contract.
Just after mid-contract, and I've been enjoying it enormously, and I believe that under the current or the new leadership, there should be a clear strategic focus on technology and science and how they can contribute to building the economy of the country. So I'm optimistic, and I'm happy to be working for the Commonwealth of Australia, not the political party.
Excellent. Now that we've done that, artificial intelligence and medicine. Where do we start with that? You can see what I'm wearing, a device that tracks my steps. How much has artificial intelligence already infiltrated our basic day-to-day lives when it comes to our health and our fitness?
So I've been calling the year 2018 as the year that artificial intelligence has arrived, certainly in the awareness of the broader community. Artificial intelligence was first coined as a term in 1956. It was first proposed as a concept in 1950 by the famous Alan Turing. And there was a lot of development, but it didn't get anywhere. The algorithmic approaches weren't adequate. The technology for the computing hardware wasn't adequate. And they called it the AI winter throughout the decades of the 80s and 90s and 70s before that. But behind the scenes, in other words, outside the visibility of the average person, it's been developing very quickly. And companies have been incorporating AI and governments have been using it, but we haven't really seen it.
So what is it?
So AI is the ability of computer technology to do things that ordinarily would require human intelligence. That's the highest level description I can give you. The next level description would be to say that AI is the combination of three very important things. It's the algorithms, which in the AI community they call machine learning. Mm. It's the high quality big data, so large data sets, and a training procedure, because you have to train the AI, the machine learning, by exposing it to the big data in a way that increases its capacity and avoids biases. Now, that is exactly analogous to a human. A human is born, and you're born with innate ability. But if you leave it at that, you'll grow up to be a vegetable. So you need the combination of innate ability in a human, that's machine learning in an AI. You need knowledge, the stuff you read, you are exposed to at school. That's the big data that the AI is getting, but humans are looking at it as knowledge. And the third, for a human, you need a good teacher. And for AI, that's the training procedure. So there's a strong analogy between HI, which is human intelligence, and AI being artificial intelligence. And it's becoming more pervasive in our society. And you asked me specifically about the impact in medicine. So we're starting to see it. For example, in reading X-rays, AI is assisting the radiologists, the experts, to read the X-rays. The FDA, for the first time this year, the FDA in America, approved an AI piece of software, an AI diagnostic, to provide a definitive diagnosis. So AI has been advising doctors in the past, but this year it was approved to diagnose diabetic retinopathy, which is a kind of blindness that diabetics are at risk of developing.
Was it a more fail or foolproof diagnosis than a human could do?
It takes a certain expertise, and so the GPs who are not expert in that would ordinarily say, look, we're suspicious, and send the patient off to an expert. But now the GP can use this AI software to do a diagnosis of medium or advanced diabetic retinopathy.
Wow.
I'll give you another example of something that's in development. And it's a terrific example of how AI can help achieve better outcomes. Think of IVF. Now, we all know somebody who's either had IVF or might have IVF or is aspiring to it. And as you know, the probability of success each time when a woman goes in is not that high. And it's very frustrating to have a failed procedure, emotionally draining, but it's also expensive. So the physicians who are running the clinic, they take multiple eggs, they fertilize them, and they watch them grow for several days into embryos, and then they have to choose the best one to implant. Well, what can a physician do? The physician, he or she, has seen maybe a few hundred or a few thousand, and they can look at these, say, once a day and make their decision. There's now AI software in development that watches the, let's say, eight embryos develop 24 hours a day. They're watching them constantly.
Watching the cells divide.
In the incubator, and they're watching the cells divide. They're looking at the shapes and the colours, the reflectivity. And based on that, and based on comparing to a knowledge base of tens of thousands of such procedures, the AI can say, this is the one that we recommend you implant. Now, that's still in development, but you can see the potential of something like that to reduce cost, to reduce angst, and deliver better outcomes.
But the difference between a doctor and AI is the human element of trust. So, do we trust AI? I read an interesting part in one of the things that you were speaking about in the Smallwood oration about a pacemaker being able storing information about your heartbeat and that being able to be used as evidence in a criminal trial as to where what your heart was doing when you said you were one place when they think you were somewhere else.
Trust is a big challenge, and we have to earn trust, and trust takes years to earn and minutes to lose. So if
that's amazing, isn't it?
Yeah. If we give our data willingly, we expect that physicians, human physicians today, will treat it absolutely confidentially, with the exception that if there is a criminal procedure and the police go to the courts, they can always get a court order to allow them to come into your home, to go into a doctor's offices. Yeah, with a court order, they can always do that. But without a court order, which is the highest level of control that we have in our society, without a court order, police and others, the tax office, can't just come in and willy-nilly do a fishing expedition and look for evidence. So trust has to be earned. The particular case you were talking about is somewhat borderline, but at least it was through a court order.
So that
It was somebody who claimed that their house had burned down and that it was just one of those circumstances, and they were claiming from insurance. There was a case, the insurance company didn't believe him, they got a court order, and it turns out he had a pacemaker that recorded his heartbeat. And throughout the period of the fire, his heartbeat was actually quite steady. Clearly, he hadn't done what he claimed. He said he saw the fire, he grabbed a bag, bolted out of the house, and stood on the sidelines. Well, that's inconsistent with his steady heartbeat. And he lost his claim for the insurance. But we're talking about a much broader use of medical health data. We're now putting our health data, many of us, into the My Health records. And there was a lot of controversy until recently. I think it's been resolved. The original legislation did not require, in principle, for the police or the ATO to get a court order to access your records. It never happened. The guidelines under which the Australian Digital Health Agency operated really made it difficult for the police, so they never did it. But the legislation allowed it. And now the Minister of Health has declared that that legislation will be tightened up. And that's important. It should be. You should never lose the existing protections by transitioning from a manual system to a digitised system to a system in which AI is involved.
But if you use things like Ancestry.com, how private is that information?
Well, that's one of the conundrums. You know, everybody wants their information to be private, and yet we live in a world where people are giving up their information on social media, Facebook, etc. And in Ancestry.com, you can submit some saliva, get some DNA testing done, or somehow otherwise upload your DNA information, which you then openly put into a database so that the software and other people can find connections, and you can work out through your genetic inheritance who you might be related to. Well, you're giving that information out. It's then a bit much to say, well, you are offended if it's used in ways that you didn't anticipate. But we still have to worry about that. So the extreme case was a case reported in America recently where a murder was solved that was about a 30-year-old murder, and it was solved by following Ancestry.com genetic links. So the outcome was good. They caught a murderer. Ethicists, lawyers, politicians need to look into this. We can't allow the increase in AI and digital technologies to happen willy-nilly.
So you're a great believer in regulation.
I'm a great believer in appropriate regulation. Regulations need to do two things. In the first instance, they need to protect the public, absolutely, for safety, privacy, whatever. And the second, they have to facilitate the development of the new commercial opportunities. We all benefit from that. So it's tempting sometimes when people are developing regulations to focus solely on the protection side of things, but that would be easy and actually not to the benefit of the community.
Alan Finkel is your guest in the studio. Dr. Alan Finkel started as Australia's chief scientist back in January 2016. He's our eighth chief scientist, and this morning we were talking about artificial intelligence and medicine. The standards that software developers are held to account when they're developing things, as distinct from the standards of the medical profession, seem to be out of alignment. How do you bring software and technology developers into alignment with some kind of artificially intelligent Hippocratic oath?
Well, at the moment in the consumer domain, it's a free-for-all. There are no regulations, so you don't know when you're using Facebook or Siri or Alexa or Google Home Assistant. You don't know anything at all about how the software was developed and how it operates. Now, you shouldn't need to, but what I'm saying to you is no one knows. It's private to them. In contrast, if you're using a kettle at home, you don't need to know how it was tested or how it was designed, but you know from looking underneath that it's got certification numbers on it that tells you the governments were absolutely managing the process of design and construction and sale of that kettle, so you're not going to get electrocuted when you touch it. But there's no one out there protecting you on consumer products at all at the moment, and I have, in the course of some of my deliberations on this, suggested that we need some kind of consumer AI regulation so that when you buy a phone and you're asking a question, you know that there were ethical guidelines that were followed by the manufacturer in developing that Siri or Google Assistant.
Is it possible to insert ethical guidelines into the development of technology? Have we done that before? With IVF, for instance, or...?
Well, we've certainly done it in the non-AI. So with IVF, absolutely, and Australia was a world leader on that. We were the first country to develop a register for registering every procedure, and that was important so that we could understand the outcomes and the consequences, and through a process of doctors coming together and initiating guidelines, which then got picked up by governments, we were the first country in the world to have guidelines for IVF procedures. It's definitely doable. What makes it particularly hard in AI is you can only do it for the things that people choose to buy or that people have controlled access to. So controlled access is medical AI that your doctor would be using, or a radiologist or a cancer therapist. Consumer products are the ones you buy. What we can't control is AI that is used almost against us by rogue states or terrorists or criminals. For that, you need very, very strong cybersecurity protections in place. So there's no single solution to our transition into the world of AI society that will be living alongside human society. We have to be looking very broadly. We need politicians involved. We need ethicists, lawyers, and the developers, the scientists, the mathematicians themselves.
So are you comfortable with AI and medicine? Are you comfortable with where we're going, or do you look at it and see a dark, you know, possibility of showers?
I have this sort of little level of concern, but it's a healthy concern. If I wasn't concerned, I would have to say, in my position, if I wasn't concerned, I was just ignoring or being blind to the realities of this rapid, powerful development. But my concern is ameliorated by my confidence that as a society, we can manage it. It's difficult to manage.
We have to want to, though.
We have to want to. So, and what drives us to want to is if we can see the clear benefits. So think about electricity, which I spoke about before, or cars, or modern medicines. They all three of those deliver enormous benefits to us, but all three of them are potentially hugely dangerous. I mean, electricity, if it wasn't regulated, would be causing house fires all the time and electrocuting people. Cars, if they weren't regulated, would be carnage on the road and explosions from poorly designed petrol tanks. And medicines, the side effects from the really powerful medicines would be killing people. We've learned to consciously manage the technologies that work for us so that the benefits far, far outweigh the risks. We need to do that for AI as well.
So what comes first? Is it sorting out the ethical Hippocratic Oath, or? Do no harm?
Yeah, the medical Hippocratic Oath is actually a terrific example of an ethical approach to AI. And if I just go straight from the medical to what it would be if it was in the context of AI, it would be AI shall do no harm. Mm-hmm. That's the first. The second would be AI shall only do what it's been proven to be capable of doing. And the third is that AI will never disclose private information.
Right. So there's a lot of work to be done then.
There is. And, you know, the Hippocratic Oath applied to AI is a good way to go. There's another wonderful approach to resolving a question that I have challenged the community with. The question is, what kind of society do we want to be?
Yeah.
And part of the answer, it's a complex answer, but part of the answer is the golden rule that was proposed by Mike Pezzullo, the secretary that's the head of the Department of Home Affairs. And that is that a human being's privileges, rights or entitlements will never be taken away by an AI without human oversight. So, for example, coming into the country, you can get entry, or you can apply for a visa and get a visa, and that can be processed and given to you by an AI. But if you're denied entry or denied a visa, then a human has to look at the case history and make the final decision.
Because can AI be infused with compassion or discretion, or, you know, like, there are all the things that you want a human, why you want the human touch?
An AI can be designed to pretend that it's got compassion, but there is absolutely no way at the moment that it can genuinely have compassion. AI doesn't care about anything. AI is just doing the tasks that it's been given to do. And that's important when it comes to AI in medicine. There was a survey done by the IEEE, a big professional interest society, and one of the things they looked at was people's responses, and what people are looking for in their physicians are knowing who you are and understanding and compassion. And what they don't like when they look at robotic type examples is that it acts robotic, that it's uncaring. People care. People want their physician to care. I think AI for the next decades or several decades will be assisting physicians. Human physicians will be and should always be in the loop.
In the loop or in charge?
I should be in charge. I think it's a stronger statement.
It's better. Alan Finkel, thank you so much. It's just a delight to meet you again and have you live in the studio to talk about artificial intelligence and medicine.
My pleasure, Libby.
The full transcript of Alan's lecture that he gave, the Smallwood Oration, is actually online. So if you put that into your search engine, Alan Finkel and Smallwood Oration, you can read the full text of the speech that inspired my mother, with my father's backing, to drag Alan in to speak with you today. Thank you.
Thank you.